Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. The book we're doing today is The Priory of the Orange Tree by, I forget the author's
Shannon,
name.
Samantha Shannon. Samantha Shannon, one of those with two first names.
As you can tell, that's my co-host, Maria.
Hi.
Who also read it. The funny thing about this book is that it's a little bit of the origin story of this podcast in that I had to read it for a book club. And it irritated me so much, and the book club irritated me so much that I was like, I need to discuss these books with, like, smart people like my friends and not randos. So that's how this started, but now we're finally getting to read it. I read it about a month ago, and you just finished it?
I haven't completely finished. I'm about a little over two-thirds the way through it. I have 6 hours left of the audiobook to go, but
okay.
I've read enough to have opinions.
I got even less. I think I got about halfway through. And so the reason I could only get through half of the book is because it's insanely boring. Now, I know you disagree a little bit, but I found this book really, really boring.
Your tolerance is also so low.
Yeah, my tolerance for boring in books is very low.
Your tolerance in books. You're a picky person. I love you.
I fully appreciate that I'm a picky person.
And watchers, Will is picky. 90% of the books we read, he will dislike.
That's true. And even the books I like, I will pick at a lot.
Yes. He is incredibly picky.
You know, it's sort of just a part of who I am. Yes. I'm very picky in everything. And so that extends to books not being perfect.
Yes.
So, but I do know you agreed with me that this book starts really. Oh, you know what? We should give a summary of it first.
Okay. So,
you go ahead and try, because I actually have trouble summarizing what the book is. And I think that's part of the problem.
The book is a retelling of a St. George and the killing of the dragon. There's a nameless big bad that has to be dealt with. The story is told from four viewpoints. Two of the characters of viewpoints are actually queer characters, which from an inclusionary standpoint is pretty cool. There's four, there should only be two. The other two are useless. The one is who I actually think is the main character. Her name is Iad Durian. That's her code name. She has an actual other name. She is from the book's name, The Priory of the Orange Tree, which is the secret society that does magic and stuff in the South. This is one of those books where there are regions that are clearly demarcated. There's the East, there's the West.
And they take like a week to travel between two.
Yes. And she's from the South, and where they worship the mother, who is a shared figure from the Northwest religion, which is called Virtudom, which worships this saint who rescued a damsel from an evil dragon, and then he slew it. And now as long as one of his...
Though weirdly, for having a patriarchal male god saint, they have female queens for some reason.
No, that gets explained at some point. I haven't gotten to that point, but it's going to get it. Like, because there's a reason, and we'll get to this. But anyway, finishing the synopsis. Anyway, so there's her. She gets sent from her priory down south off to the northern kingdom of... Like England, the England analog.
Yeah, England. And she's like a secret agent there to like protect the queen undercover.
Yeah, she's a bodyguard to protect the queen. And then we have Ardaloth Beck, who is one of the useless narrators. He's rich guy who was friends with Iad. He got sent away because they thought he was canoodling with the queen and that would hurt her marriage prospects. So he gets sent off and ends up going on like a journey that ends up impacting the plot, and then he loses all relevance the minute that's done. And then there's Tane, who's the other character that I think actually like should be a viewpoint character. She's from the East, where there's dragons and then there's worms. The Eastern dragons are actually dragons, and they came from a comet and a celestial object. And then the worms come from the bowels of the earth. They come from fire. The other dragons come from starlight. It's all very poetic. But anyway, Tana comes from a society where she's been. They worship dragons. They have a close relationship with the water dragons. Oh, yeah. The star dragons also live in the water. So there's that. And she's been training her whole life to become a dragon rider. And she does. And eventually her story connects to the main story. Like, two-thirds through the book, it finally connects. And then there's Nicolaus Roos, who is the oldest, like, by far. Everyone else is in, like, 20s. And then Nicolaus Roos is, like, a 50-something-year-old, like, has-been alchemist who's been isolated.
Exiled.
He was exiled. That's the word I was looking for, to the east. And his story ends up, again, eventually connecting to the main plot. But he's exiled in Psyche. The Japan analog?
We'll talk a little bit later about the cultural markers because it's a little odd.
But anyway, he's on this eastern island. The eastern people don't interact with the West or anyone else at all for fear of the draconic plague, which is this thing that hovers over everything. And he's stuck there. And then eventually he gets unstuck by doing bad stuff.
Yeah, he's a terrible person and we're supposed to sympathize with him for some reason.
Yeah, and then he ends up being a surgeon on a pirate ship who stole Tane's dragon, and that's when his story finally intersects with the rest of the story. anyway, and it all culminates, and I haven't gotten to the actual culmination, but it's heading towards defeating the big bad, the nameless dragon, worm creature who's in the bowels of the earth waiting to be released. Yeah, so that's the story.
That's the story. And like, as you can tell, because it takes so long, I think it's funny because I in college, I was the editor of the Honors College Journal, right? Not to brag to everyone and make all the women attracted to me. And it was funny. Always the problem with a paper was that they didn't have a clear thesis statement. Mm-hmm. And because they didn't have a clear one, it's not that the paper didn't do well because they didn't have a clear one. It's that they couldn't write the paper well because they didn't have a clear idea of what it was. And I feel like this book is a little bit like that in that it's kind of all over the place because you can't say what the premise is easily. It kind of sprawls all over the place and is meandering. You don't think there should be two of the viewpoints. I don't think there should be three. I really just think it should be Iyad if you were going to write the story. The other three people don't really seem to do anything in a way that interacts with each other until the very end. And I don't feel like their narrative adds anything thematically.
As is, as currently written, you're right. Iyad should be the sole point of view. So I will argue Will does not like Nicolaus Roos at all. I will argue that he becomes a better character and I find him more likable as the book goes on, but also like just a little extraneous.
Here's the thing about him. I think he's a good character. I don't think he's interesting enough to be as dislikable as he is. And I think his use in the plot
again,
is like,
I don't think he's as dislikable as you think he is.
Well, you got later in the book. Early on, he's just grumpy all the time.
Yeah, no. Early on in the book, the entire first third of the book, like about 250 pages, and I think it's about 800 pages. So actually, even 250 is a little less than a third. But the first 250 pages, which is sometimes the length of an entire book, mm-hmm. is just, it's a little painful. Lots of exposition, really slow. You don't understand. And especially in the beginning.
It's awful.
The first four chapters.
I feel like the first eight or nine actually are just people sitting and talking about the political situation and very little actually happens.
Oh, yes, absolutely that.
And also, this is not that complex or interesting of a world, and the politics of it are not that interesting. This isn't a Song of Ice and Fire, where, like, you know, the author really understands politics and how to make people maneuver and make them interesting. In this one, the politics are fairly straightforward, and yet we sit and talk about them forever. And the problem is, because she has four viewpoints, she has to set up, you know, when you set up a viewpoint, you have to do certain things. You have to be like, okay, you have to introduce the character, you have to introduce their surroundings, you have to introduce a main conflict, you have to introduce a cast around them, like a secondary cast. So she has to do that four times. And so that naturally slows everybody down. And they're all in separate locations, so she can't use them to characterize each other. It's just four slow starts. Introducing those four viewpoints separate from each other just causes so many problems that are already inherent to the book. So there's already an exposition problem, and there's already a taking too long problem, and then you expound that by four. And I think that's one of the big hurdles to getting into the book, because the plot does start moving along after a while.
Yeah. After about like 250 pages, like I said, the first third-ish, the book actually finds its legs plot-wise. And that was the point where Will and I began. Now, I still have issues. While I don't dislike the book as much as Will did after those first 250 pages, there's still problems that we will absolutely discuss, because Mama loves a good rip-in. It does pick up, and I was able to, like, you know, like, have it on while I'm driving and, you know, like, enjoy the experience. Like, I didn't, or like, not even enjoy the experience, but it was happening and I was a witness, you know, like, it's there, and I was interested as long as I'm not doing anything else. But that's me with all audiobooks. But the big issue with the first four chapters in particular, especially, and I don't know if this is something that happens in the actual book, so people who read it actually, please give your comments, but we both did audiobook, and the first four chapters are crazy audiobook because it's just name, place, mentioned on, all these just things, and you're like, who?
I can't actually even remember any of the random names.
I've forgotten the mainland, but there's mentioned on, there's Psyche, there's the 12 Kingdom-y place, which is the like China analog, I think. We'll discuss the race stuff in a sec. There's, I forgot, it starts with an L.
They throw so many names that sound random fantasy that it's super annoying and hard to follow.
And it's really, like, it's just a lot. And you just get a lot of character names and all this stuff just thrown at you. And like,
it's like every bad stereotype of high fantasy names just thrown at you all at the same time. You're like, ugh. I mean, part of the reason I think I had issues with the book is this is the first high fantasy book I've read in a while. You know, the last two books I read were Baron the Nightingale and Spinning Silver. And before that, just various other books that were like more low fantasy. That's the kind of thing I like. And so it was a bit of a gear shift to go back into like, oh, there's a magic system and people talk about magic and it's not supposed to feel mystical and interesting. And there's like seven different countries with the same names, and it was frustrating to get through, and there wasn't a compelling,
they don't have the same names, his tolerance is really low. It's like
they all do have the same name.
Mentendon, Psyche, the L one that I've forgotten, but it's completely different. It has a C in it somewhere. The other one, like the names of the countries are not at all. Don't let him try trick you. They're
No. They are all clearly as made up as each other. They're not really culturally distinct in the name, which is difficult when you're being thrown a bunch of them without any real strong changes to them. Like, can you tell me how...
I think Psychonese was supposed to have a, like, earworm effect to Chinese.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense over time.
Mentendon is the Netherlands analog because they get to trade... with Japan. I mean Psyche.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yes. There's a whole bunch of, you didn't pick those up?
Honestly, again, I know that there was the main Englandy place, another place that was like Italy-ish a tiny bit, and then another place that went to work for the bad dragons, and then some Asian countries.
Yeah, so the
and this is after having read half the book.
Mentendon is, I think you're thinking, the Italy place.
I just remember thinking it was vaguely Italy-ish.
So I think why you're thinking that is because of the Renaissance and like the quest for enlightenment, because Mentendon is a place of like researchers, and so I think that's you equated it with Italy. But I also think there's a little bit of like a Netherlands because they got to trade.
I actually don't disagree. I think just she needed to up how culturally distinct they were to make it easier.
Yeah, so that I will give it's, you.
At something like, and there's no keywords in there. So again, if you look at something like A Song of Ice and Fire, it's like Riverlands, Northlands, those are like in the name, there's a thing you can grasp onto that you know what it is versus, you know, Mentendon versus Psyche. Something else. Yeah, like there's a reason that you try to ground your names a little bit more. And I did catch on eventually to some of what was going on, but it never really became
super clear. Yeah, no, the first four chapters were just until you've read like 250 pages.
Nothing. And they just sit around and talk about it. So it's a bunch of people sitting around talking about something you don't understand.
And like in the first chapter with Yid, or like the first major thing she does is she interviews this lady named, she's a lady in waiting to the queen, named Trude. And Trude is from Mentendon. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, where's Mentendon? She's not from here. She's not from where you, like, you obviously aren't, because everybody looks at you kind of, and like your name's very different and you're described as completely different visually. But this lady sounds like, where is this Mentendon place? Like, is it a county of this kingdom?
I assumed originally, yeah, it was more like a county, like Gloucester to London versus like France to England. Like, I did not understand the relationship between these places, and it was very difficult to get through.
It's also really hard to have like differentiation between like kings and queens when the one queen is believed to be like the descendant of your like saint that you've built your religion around. Like, why? Like, because Mentandon has its own king. The place that eventually gets taken over by the Draconic forces that used to be part of Virtudom has their own king and queen. And I'm like,
oh, that's the one that I thought was more Italy-ish.
I don't know why, but because of the lavender fields, I got a definite France analog.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because France is known for its giant lavender. But again, none of these places, like Will and I had this issue at the beginning of the book where he was like, they're this thing. And I'm like, really? They are? And then I started doing research about like the characters and how people were visualizing them. And this was a huge issue that I will agree with. I had no idea what anybody actually looked like. It didn't occur to me that the Cycones were actually Asian until they started talking about eating like bean paste and...
Okay, all right. So this is the part where we have to discuss the difference between the audiobook and the book.
Yes.
I read the audiobook, right? Or I listened to the audiobook. In the audiobook, the narrator, she uses a British voice for the England-y place. And then for every foreign accent, she either uses a Caribbean accent or a Nigerian West African type accent. And she does this for people regardless of where they're from. So the place that I thought was Italy and the place you thought was France-ish, you know, I don't remember that one's name, she uses a West African accent.
See, I didn't find that one West African-y. The Asian people definitely...
Yeah, Tane is Tane. Clearly, like, I thought that was straight up African.
I also thought that was African. And also because, like, you can't initially place yourself, because how it opens is Tane training in this, like, isolate, like, she lives in this yes. house with people. So, like, there's no cultural markers. It wasn't until, again, they started talking about eating bean paste and, like, obviously Asian-inspired, like, bean sprouts.
The dragons are Asian-inspired
exactly.
as well.
Exactly, and the water relation that I began to realize, oh, this is Asia. And so part of that was the accent. And then, like, Iyad, who I can argue from the book I don't think is coded. So some people see Iyad as Middle Eastern, and some people see her as more, like, African. In how they fan portray her. And I think for her, it can go either way, but she specifically and all her people specifically have like this Caribbean accent.
I think it's a case too. I mean, I think, you know, you could also make the case that she is both Black and Eastern in terms yes. of like, that's a thing that happened and yep. like it could be an amalgamation of the two, but it's really Caribbean. And so that actually very much threw me off in trying to figure out A, what time period this was set, and B, what I was supposed to understand about the England-y place. Like, I thought, okay, this is a colonial power because they have a Caribbean analog, and this can't be in a medieval time period, but actually it's neither of those things, which is just, as an author, you have to understand the implications and the contextual clues that various cultural markers give the reader. And so all those are blown up if your narrator decides to give them an accent that has nothing to do with what you wrote. So that was really frustrating and threw me off for a long time.
Yeah, me too. And it we then started having discussions about like what actually are, because like it's never, like I said, the best you get for Tane is like the foods and some like, again, smaller cultural markers. But as far as like Mentandon, Innis, that's what it is. Innis is the England analog.
Oh, yeah.
But like the other place, the place that gets taken over by the, like, what's the difference culturally between Mentandon, Innis, and the place with the lavender fields that gets burned because of the draconic forces? Like, I have no idea.
No, to me, there's three cultures. There's the pseudo-European one that's broken into three countries, which yes. is very generically fantasy. It's not even specifically a European country. There's the Japanese-y one, and then there's the Eastern one. And like, those are the only three that I really caught on to in terms of
the South, the Southern.
Is that what it is?
Yes. The East is the Japanese-y.
There's one part where she's on a caravan, Iyad, and there's a guy who I swear has an American accent.
Yes, he does.
Right? It's really odd.
He does. It's throwing.
And he's supposed to be from like a Middle Eastern country.
And here's the thing. I like the narrator for her ability to make distinct voices for the characters. Like she's really, like, she's good at playing men. She's good at playing women. She's good at accents. But I kind of wish the woman, there's this woman who narrated this book series, and I can't remember what her name is. She's done quite a bit of Jacqueline Carey's books, and she's really good with accents, different places. But she can also do, like, you know, like a Russian accent. She can do a French accent. She can do like a bunch of, like, a lot. She can do a lot of accents. And I kind of wish we had someone like her, because I feel like this lady had like maybe five accents she could do. And so, like, congratulations, these are what we got. But as far as what she can do, she's great. I like her normal reading voice.
Yeah, I agree.
I like the voices she gives. the main characters, again, besides like the accents, but the actual, because sometimes I have a hard issue with narrators who can't differentiate their voices. Or one of my other biggest pet peeves is like a guy, like when they get those old grizzly guys to narrate and then he's doing a woman's voice and he's like, hello there. And you're like,
that always to me never works. It always works better for a woman to act like an old man than for an old man to act like a woman.
Especially a sexy woman. Like the minute she's supposed to be alluring and it's just like,
no,
an old man.
No,
like,
please no. Hello. God no. It's so I'm having that problem with the one I'm listening to now.
I also heard that's one of the big issues with the Song of Ice and Fire trilogy. Or it's trilogy. Bajillany.
Yeah, no, that's why I've never listened to them. It's because the guy just... I'm currently listening to Dune, and they actually have like 6 or 7 different voice actors on that. Like, it's a real production, mm-hmm. and that's really nice. But unfortunately, there is an old guy voicing one of the female characters, and I hate it.
That's hysterical. I don't know why that ends up happening.
And again, I think it's just, it
exacerbates the issue of race.
Well, and just the lack of cultural markers and really visualization.
Yes, that's it. It's really just the cultural markers and trying to figure out, like, what does this world look like? And so, like, one of the things is a big thing for Iyad is wearing, like, the petticoats and, like, the stomachers and everything in Innis. But we never really get described what the clothing is like where she's from. She even goes back there.
Yeah.
And like, it's like a one throwaway line. And I'm like, you spent so much time complaining about the clothing up there. Can I get a visual of what it looks like down here? And so it just, and again, it's one of those things that happens when you literally just demarcate your world by north, south, east, and west. You know, like,
yeah,
this is what happens. And again, I didn't know Psyche was in the east for the longest time because it just wasn't readily described.
And I think that actually that lack of culturalness, like of cultural identity to these places, actually really hurts Iyad's storyline. Because Iyad, the idea behind it is she's undercover trying to protect this queen who believes her people are like witches and bad. And she's been there for like 10 years. And so every once in a while, she talks about how she has to fit in there and pretend to be a different religion than she is and how, you know, she's kind of alone. But I feel like that could have been explored so much more than it actually is. And there could have been such a more double consciousness for her between like, okay, are these people really my friends? Are they not? How much can I act versus not act? Like all this, like, who am I really if I'm pretending to be this or that? How much do I hang on to my original identity? And the thing with Iyad, and honestly, this is a problem with all the characters, I didn't feel like they drove the plot. I felt like the plot drove them. All of the plot things felt very impersonal to them. Even when they do things in them, I never got a very strong feeling that Iyad felt strong about anything.
So that comes. And that's one thing that I think reading the book helped with, because I will agree. And as you heard when I was giving my summary of the book, there's a lot of people who don't connect to the plot until the end. So Tene and Iyad eventually do end up driving plot themselves a little, like, especially Iyad, when she discovers the jewel.
About halfway through?
A little over the halfway point. So yeah, it is literally, and again, this is a 800 page book. You do not want to be 400 pages in before your character, because literally, like, we'll use Iyad as a case study. She's sent from the Priory to Innis to protect Sabran. She literally spends 8 years just hanging out, killing cutthroats when they come to kill the queen, trying to figure out what's going on. But again, there's stuff happening and she's trying to figure it out. It's not her driving it. Then they discover, because her and Sabran get it on,
that which we'll talk about extensively.
which we will not. But anyway, there's a romance that builds up, and it's quite. And I'll actually say that's a nice slow burn. I was here for that.
That was the only part of the book I really liked, actually, was their relationship.
Of course it was. Of course.
Look, because it was tender, and I...
It was tender.
I'm really progressive. When two very femme lesbians have a relationship, I'm fully in support of it.
Okay, listen, you're going to make people think terrible things about you. He's being, like...
I'm being facetious. No, I did actually really like their relationship in that...
But yeah, so
you go ahead.
She develops this relationship, because we'll just talk about the relationship, but I'm still using her as a case study for a lack of plot involvement. So yeah, she develops a relationship with Sabran. They consummate the relationship. And then immediately, like literally next morning, this guy's like, you can't be in the queen's bed. We're exiling you. Get out. We're arresting you. And then she has to escape. And again, so she's leaving not by her own volition or because she decided, but because they're literally like gonna exile her. So she runs off, she goes back to her home. And part of this is because she's now found out it's a little two-pronged. The whole point of the Breathnet Queens is they have to have one daughter because there's this belief at the heart of the religion where if there isn't a Breathnet Queen anymore, the nameless one, the evil bad dragon, will rise up and destroy everyone. So to ensure the safety, there must always be a queen. But Zebron, who was pregnant, got a stabby stab through the belly, and now she's barren, and she lost her baby, and it's very sad for her. I felt really bad. Zebron is an interesting character, and I quite like her.
Yeah.
I would have almost liked one of the point of views to have been her, but anyway. And so she now can't have a kid, which is a huge issue, and Ead realizes that her, like, almost like her retainers, like her people around her, her...
Yeah.
Some shit's gonna go down. And so she tries to send a letter to her people back at the Priory. And then when she ends up getting exiled, she's like, I'll just go tell them myself. But again, she was gonna stay. It was because she was exiled that she ends up fleeing. She flees, she gets there. And it's only once she's there and she's back that does she actually make a decision for herself that changes her course.
Right. 400 pages in.
400 pages in. She finds one of the jewels. You find out from a dragon named Nyunathen, who's Tanny's dragon, once she becomes a dragon rider, that there are these two jewels that can control the ocean and that control the magic that comes from the comet, because there's this comet that appears once every 1,000 years.
By the way, they only mention that like halfway through the book. This is not a thing that was set up early.
This is not, and it's really
the thing important that drives the last half of the book is not even known about.
Yeah, it's really like most odd of it. There's this power dynamic between like the fire in the earth and then this star above the ground, and when one gets too powerful, the other one has to balance it. The fire is getting too powerful, but the comet's not supposed to come by anytime soon, so the way to offset that is to find these two jewels that are made from fragments of this comet that can help. They, number one, will restore the magic to the eastern dragons so they can fight the worms. And Tanny finds one of these jewels and she's like, I'm gonna go do stuff with this. And then her prioress is like, no, we don't care about anyone except for the south. And she's like, no, I would like to go back and save the woman I love and make sure Virtudom doesn't fall into chaos. And so she has like this jewel of power. She's now going on a quest to find Ascalon so she suddenly becomes driving force to defeat the big bad. She needs to find the sword that'll actually kill it. She needs the jewels that'll disable it. So she's off on an adventure. She busts into Virtudom. They take over. Sabran's been like put in a tower in the dark and being tortured by the woman who raised her. It's real. Like, it gets a little fucked up. But it's only at that point. Yeah, no, it's actually quite sad. Their reunion scene is really cute.
That was honestly the only reason I was thinking of reading the book is just skipping to Ead's chapters and to see like how her and Sabran's relationship worked out.
I'd recommend it because it's actually really cute. But anyway,
I can't monetize it now for content, so no.
But anyway, so Ead, only at that point that she has the jewel and decides to go against the Priory, only at that point does she start driving her own plot. And we have a similar thing happen with Tanne.
Well, so her plot starts with her sending some guy to the evil doctor dude who I don't like very much.
Tanne has to be in seclusion because the next day is the choosing ceremony of whether she gets to be a scholar or a dragon rider person. And she decides to be like fun and adventurous and go for a swim in the ocean during her seclusion, which she's not supposed to do. And while she's there, she finds an outsider. And outsiders are a huge no-no for the Cycnese society in case they have the draconic plague. So rule number one, you see an outsider, you immediately need to report it. But if she reports it, then she can't. What if they...
Can we side note? I thought the draconic plague was going to be way cooler than it is. Because it sounds cool, and then it's just like a fever. I was like, maybe it gives you scales. Maybe it turns you into a dragon. Maybe it makes you crazy. And it's like, no, it's basically just a fever.
It does make you crazy.
It makes you a little crazy. But I thought like cool... zombie worshiping dragon cult, like I thought it was gonna be really cool because it's the draconic plague and it's like they get a fever and go a little crazy.
But yeah, so she sees this guy. She decides, rather than tell the authorities and risk ruining the ceremony she's been waiting for her whole life, she's gonna hide him. So she gets her friend Sousa to hide him on this trade. There's a little island that the mentish people are allowed to trade with, but that's the only place they can come into Psyche from. They don't get to go anywhere else. On that island is Nicleus Roos, which is how their stories briefly connect, and then they'll connect later. And so she brings the outsider to Nicleus, and then she goes off to do her dragon thing, and it isn't
until... Well, and the thing is, like, after that point, yeah, she's just, like, other people tell her what to do, and her plot proceeds that way. And in terms of Nicleus, his plot is not him making any real decisions. It's this guy being thrust on him and not him not having any other options until another guy tells him he has to go to the Capitol. And then from there, he decides to blackmail Tane and then gets captured. So like almost all, besides that one decision, almost all of his plot is driven by other people having him do things. Loth is even worse in that before his chapter starts, he's pushed off and told to go to a place. And then another person tells him there to go to another place. And then a magic ferret shows up and has him go to another place. None of these actions are driven by the characters. And it's a real problem. It's like novel writing 101 that you shouldn't do this.
Loth's biggest character uniqueness is that he has a thing for the Don Marta.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was Italy-ish, because it sounds very slightly Italy-ish.
That's it. He has the hots for a princess who's been trapped. Like, that's as much, like, unique. And then he was friends with
Sabran.
That
they only talk in one chapter for?
Yeah. And then he's friends with Sabran. And that's Ardaloth back. Like, Nicolaus Roos, at least, like, once he's with the pirates, he uses his alchemy skills to figure out, like, this mappy, texty thing that leads them, that gives them direction to this island where something cool is supposed to be. They think one of the jewels are there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so anyway, Tane, nothing happens to her until she discovers a jewel has been stitched into her side. So like I said, there's those two magic. So it is. Why is it there? I don't know yet. I haven't gotten that far. But anyway, the one jewel Iad ends up finding and then starts her actual active quest. And then Tane's like little bump is hurting and she eventually loses her position as dragon rider because stuff. And the guy she's like, the scholar she's living with is like, that looks weird. We should get someone to check that out. And the doctor cuts to do an incision. And in the middle of the doctor being like, hey, that doesn't look like bone. Like there's an attack from a worm and Tane's just running. And then this jewel just pops out of her side.
Are you serious?
You didn't get to that scene? Part. Oh my God. It's hysterical. Like, it's the other jewel. It's literally the other jewel. And it's just been in her side the whole time. And she's getting this thing. And she's high. So they give her opium analog. And so she's high as a kite. A dragon attacks. So there's dragon fire coming in. She has to run to the river. She's high as a kite. And then, you know, the jewel pops out. And then as she, like, this worm comes and she's face to face with it. And then she's like, I don't know why, but I have the urge. Because she's also, for her, she knows what the jewel is. Kind of, because Naimithin had her dragon mm-hmm. had told her about the jewels, why she would assume the jewel that came out of her side. She doesn't actually assume it, but she gets a feeling to hold up the jewel, and she holds it up, and a light appears, and the worm goes and runs away. Congratulations, you have a jewel of power.
I did not get to that part, and I'm a little sad I didn't.
It's so, you know, it's the thing so great.
It really feels like a teenage novel that was upscaled and written a little bit better, but like whose main plot point somebody came up with when they were a teenager. Like, oh, magic jewels and four people and then a quest, and then like, and they never really stopped to think about like, okay, how do these people, what do they want, how do their emotional realizations drive the plot forward and their actions. And it's super frustrating to read.
And more so than that for me, because there is a little bit of a feeling with these books of like the Deus Machina, like the somehow stuff works when it shouldn't, and little writing things would have fixed it. And this was a huge issue for me as I was reading, because I, like I said, Will, I would say, really dislikes the book. I can read it enjoyably, but it would have these moments that would just smack me out of the story so hard that it would upset me.
Well, what's funny actually is, before you get into that, this is actually me chilled out because I read it a month ago. I was so much more mad when it was wasting my time.
Guys, it was so like, bad.
I can't stand things that waste my time.
And then I was reading it and I was like, this isn't that, like, it's why so much feeling? Like, this isn't worth
That's
it.
That's hilarious.
But anyway, what it is like, stuff will just happen. My one issue was like, bad stuff happens all at once really quickly. With Tane, we'll use her storyline. Like, she, for about 200 pages, has no fallback from getting her friend to send the outsider to the place. And within like 30 pages, she finally confesses to her dragon what happens. They're starting to like fix things. And then her friend is murdered. Her dragon is kidnapped by pirates. And like, it just all happens so quickly. Like, because the entire time with Tanny's plot, you're waiting for the shoe to drop that like mm-hmm. this outsider thing is going to come back for her. And then like all the bad shit happens all at once, condensed into a tiny little space of time that you're just like, oh God, let me breathe. Similarly, you have with like Artaloth, he has his friend Kit that goes on the adventure with him. He gets exiled with him. And then when they go to do the Don Marta's or whatever her name is, and like literally they decide to like to go on this quest and to avoid draconic powers, they have to give themselves the draconic plague. And she wants them to give like get the specific type of plague her father has. So not only has he been exiled, but he has to give himself the plague. He then tells his best friend what his plan is. And his friend's like, I'm coming with. I'm giving myself the plague too. They set off in the tunnels and immediately his friend is crushed by rockfall. There's like an immediate earthquake. Like, it's not like he went on the first leg of the journey and then he died. Like 20 minutes into the journey, his friend dies. And it's like, why did you bring Kit along to just kill him like that? Because it has no weight. If they had bonded together on the journey even more.
Well, and he was such a stock character too, that it was like, he was kind of the smart ass best friend. And like, he's not really a character in his own right. So when he dies, you're like, okay, I see what you did there, but I don't
see what you did there. You did it too soon. Like there's timing, lady. You didn't. And that's the thing. There's these timing issues and then places where things just work out. And so again, Kit goes on an adventure. He's attacked by a worm, which he was literally told if he gave himself the draconic plague, he would not be attacked by worms or draconic creatures.
Yeah, that was weird.
So he's attacked by a worm and then he gets saved by a magic ferret creature.
Who has not been mentioned before this in the book, by the way. This is the first mention of him in 400 pages.
Yes, it's so draconic. Well, I'd say like 300 at this point.
300,
yeah, okay. But anyway, so draconic ferret, or not draconic ferret, magic ferret, and who saves him, who defeats the worm, slashes its throat, and then is just like, come right on my back. And he can't speak, or we think. But he seems to understand loss. And they go in, and the ferret just takes him. It's not a ferret. What's that? It's almost like a mongoose parallel that like that stomp on stakes.
But ferret is way funnier.
Yeah, ferret is funnier. But anyway, so the ferret just takes him, like literally just finishes the journey for him, takes him where he needs to go. And then it turns out the ferret belonged to Iad's people the whole time. Like, how did they know to find him? How, like, it just, and all you needed to do was just change how he stumbled. Like, what would have worked better is if he had gotten to a village and was like, I need to get to this place and talk to this man. And then if the ferret, who maybe there was a bunch of ferrets hanging out, was like, huh, he needs to talk to my master, I'll take him then. Or like anything.
No,
like,
it's true. Or like, he could have saved the ferret's life. That would have had him being an active character versus somebody who just literally gets saved and then picked up by a magical creature that was just introduced and then sent to somewhere else. This book is beginning to infuriate me again because it's so shoddily written. All right, let's talk about something I actually like.
Okay,
which is Iad's relationship with Sabran, who is the queen. So partly I have a weakness for like ice queen type characters, and Sabran is like very bitchy and like I actually liked that about her.
She is.
In that there's an uncompromisingness to how she's written, in that, you know, especially even once you start learning more about like her trauma and what's going on with her internally and why she is the way she is, the author doesn't flinch away from making her really mean at times.
She's a spoiled queen with issues.
With issues. And like, I thought she was a really well-sketched character in that way. And I felt like the closeness between her and Iad kind of grew in a way that felt natural and even unexpected, because I didn't think that was where the story was going to go originally. So it has a little bit more of a realness to it because you don't see the author's hand as much. Mm-hmm. But that was not enough quite to save the book for me. And then also, then she leaves halfway through and I was like, all right, that's it. I'm done with this book. I don't
care.
She
goes back after 100 pages. She's really not gone long.
At the time she wrote this, I believe the author was 25 or so. So there's a little bit of like,
she'd already written an entire sci-fi series, just so you know.
Are you serious? Like, never mind.
Or something. Like, she did.
Never
this
mind.
This was her first standalone and her first high fantasy.
And hopefully her last.
Again, I don't think it's that bad. Like, it's got issues, but I found myself enjoying certain aspects of the plot. Like, I began to enjoy Roos more as he had a more paternal, like, instinct toward Trude. I liked his romance with Trude's grandfather as much as you didn't.
No, I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
That did make me like his character more. And like you said, with his loyalty to him, even in death with Trude, but he's still just not a good person and he's still really grumpy all the time.
For me, what did it was when he started like actively trying to follow, because like there's this huge issue of him having issues of loss. So the loss of his career, but also the loss of his lover before they ever actually got to be together for realsies. Because his lover dies on a quest to find out the meaning of this scrap of paper that he thinks is really important to the history of
coincidentally becomes important to the book's plot.
And when Nicolaus finally starts trying to solve it, partially because his life's at risk, but also he gets into it from an emotional place of like, he's gonna like finish this thing that his lover started, that I enjoyed. And I also liked, I don't know if you got to the part where he's on the pirate ship and he starts bonding with the translator lady and they develop.
I did get to that. I actually really liked the idea of him getting onto like cool pirate, Asian pirate lady's ship who hunts dragons. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a really cool idea, and I really liked it. It's just by that point, the well was poisoned to me with him. I think what it is that it's a couple of things. He's unsympathetic. He's a loser in that, like, he really is. He just loses a lot. He's not, like, a tough or smart character. And he's not funny. There are a lot of people who are bad characters, but if they're funny, they become likable. Mm-hmm. Or if they, like, are badasses, they become likable. He's just all the things you don't want in a character. He's not sympathetic, he's not cool, and he's not funny. So he's just all three are lost.
I found him sympathetic. And again, it might just be that I have a higher tolerance than you, but I did.
You do.
It took me about a third into the book for Nicolaus to win me over. And again, I think the character I like the best is Sabron. Weird, like, again... And partially because, like, and yeah.
I found Sabron the most interesting character she's the most in terms compelling. Of what's going on with her. So that actually does bring me to an interesting question, which is, are you going to finish this book now that we can't monetize it?
Oh, me? Yeah, absolutely. It's not. Listen, the last book I didn't finish was because I hated the characters so much that every time they interacted, it was painful. And it was a Sarah J. Maas book. I forgot which one. I think it was The Throne of Glass. It was one of those.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it was just really, like, I didn't mind the writing style, and I didn't even, I think I got about halfway through, the plot wasn't terrible, but the characters were just so unlikable that I got to a point that I didn't care. All of them could burn. And with this, I still care about, like I want to know what happens to Sabron. I want to know why all the women in her family look exactly the same. Like, because so far, that hasn't been explained. At oil. Why are these a bunch of women who have almost the same face? Besides, like, it didn't dimp. One has a dimple, and some have curly hair, and some have straight hair, and some, like, that's weird. And so I want to know what happens there. And also, I want to see Tene actually be a badass. This entire time, we've seen her, like, training to be a badass, and I'm here for that moment of. And I also want to find out about this Naporo witch. Like, there are elements that I want to know about.
There are mysteries that you're still interested in.
And again, I listen to this book times when I'm not doing anything. When I'm driving, when I'm cleaning, when I go to the gym. Like, moments where, like, the other option is to listen to music. And I enjoy having, like, a story told to me. I mean, that's a huge reason I got through, like, a lot of books that I've read recently, was because it's, like...
It's the only reason I've gotten back into reading. It's too bad Audible doesn't sponsor us, but...
Sponsors.
But no, it really is. It's, like, what makes it possible for me. But, like, it's interesting, because you sound almost like a completist, where I'm, like, the opposite of a completist.
I walk away from books, but they have to be way worse than this.
To be fair, I also, it sounds like I bounced off at the boring middle part right before a lot of this stuff starts picking up. I'm going to just keep trashing on this book forever. So,
yes, so we can,
I think we'll call it here.
But again, I know we said a lot of negative things, but it really, like, a lot of people, especially if you're looking for representation, if you're looking for a YA novel where you're going to feel a little seen.
You should ask for better.
Don't, again, it's not a bad book. It's not a great book. It's a good issue.
I would say if you bounce off after, like, the first four chapters, then it's not a book for you. And if you can stick it out,
yes, that's exactly
400. If you're okay with sticking something out for about 400 pages, then you should be good with this book.
And I've read, like, professional reviews that have similar takes to this. I read one that was, like, really glowing, and then this lady from Tor wrote a review that really, for me, hit a lot of the issues that I had with it.
Oh, I'll have to check that out.
Oh, no, she compares it to some books she's read recently as well, and like why the length of it really is its downfall, and which I thought was absolutely like super valid. But again, a lot of people have really loved this book, and I am not here to take that away. And
it's kind of a bit like The Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear by Patrick Rothfuss, in that those books are way too long. But some people really enjoy them.
Yeah. And so, like, don't let what we said, number one, color your potential experience with it. Read it. Go ahead. You know, like, there's absolutely some cool bits in it and some things that I haven't seen out of fantasy before. I'm not talking about the representation.
Like what?
Like someone having a jewel literally embedded in their side. Central to the plot. It's been here the whole time.
I just thought that was a pimple the whole time.
She was like, I just thought it was this weird bone spur thing. And, you know, like, I've had it since I was a child. And her dragon is literally next to her talking about these lost jewels. And it's literally, like, just right there. And, like, I like the relationship.
I would say this. There's three people listening to this, so it doesn't really matter if they take our advice or not. And secondly, it's not that good a book.
It's a goodish book. Like
it's, again, it's competently written.
6 out of 10.
It really just feels like a book she plotted out when she was like 15, and then came back to the outline of and was like, I really like this, I'm gonna write it, and then didn't think about how she should
edit it,
really change a lot of the core things.
What number rating? So I've given it a 6 out of 10. I didn't say I like it. I said it's not bad. And I find moments where I enjoy it. Again, there are a lot of moments that snap me out of it and I get really mad at her as a writer for some of the decisions, but there are moments that I get into it and I forget.
I don't love giving books scores, but I'll say this right now. I think 6 out of 10 isn't a bad score. I think that's pretty valid. Well, okay. So first of all, though, I only consider like 9s and 10s to be really good.
Yeah,
books worth my time.
I would agree.
But
I agree.
I would also say that a month ago while I was reading this, I probably would have given it like a 3 or a 4. I was getting so pissed off at it. It wasn't even a book I could hate read. Books I could hate read, I would.
So
I finished books I hate read.
Picky.
At some point, we're going to read Savior's Champion by Jenna Maresi. I'm going to force you guys to read that because I finished that book by hate reading it and then being validated by the 2-star reviews on Goodreads. And I'm going to go look at the Goodreads ones for this because I forgot to.
No, they're pretty good. Like, you're not going to have that.
No, you got to find the 2-star ones.
Oh, like specifically reading the 2-star ones.
Actually, you know, the way you know if a book is actually bad is if the 2-star reviews are coherent instead of like kind of not making sense. You know how like sometimes it's just people writing out like, I hated this book, but if like it's a long, well-written essay, you're like, okay, this book actually might have been bad. But all right, so that's going to be it for us. Tune in next time when Katie will be back. I know you guys all missed her, but it was nice to have a break from her. I'm just kidding. We both love Katie. All right, talk to you guys later. Bye.
Bye.